Good evening. Welcome to Home Fires. I'm your host, Patty Kostelic, and our subject tonight is something that you can sink your teeth into. We're going to talk about cooking. And in fact, we're talking about something even better than cooking. We're talking about American cooking, which we can all identify with. I'm going to read you a little passage that's been written by my guest tonight. I have been called a maverick in the kitchen by food writers and students. I'm not at all. I simply cook as I see fit and allow nothing to intimidate me. I grew up on a ranch in South Dakota, eating wonderful food cooked by my maternal grandmother. She could create amazing things from little that was at hand, and the memories of her skillet breads and baked goodies will never leave me. I am forever indebted to two wonderful mentors, June Platt and James Beard, who got me started on my cooking career by teaching me an awareness of what I was eating and how best to prepare it. Today, one hears a lot about, quote, American cuisine, unquote, and I think it is high time we took proper pride in it. From the beginning, the keynote of good American cooking has been simplicity. At its best, it is an unpretentious and straightforward approach to food. Good basic ingredients properly cooked without any unnecessary seasonings or sauces to mask the true flavors. I think that's a wonderful statement, Richard Nelson. And in the studio with me this evening are Richard Nelson, who is the author of Richard Nelson's American Cooking, and Jennifer Jolis, who is responsible for bringing Richard to Fairbanks, among other things. We'll leave those till later because I promised I wouldn't pick on her right away. Obviously, you are supportive of American cooking, and this is a country that's been, other than the joy of cooking, fairly hesitant to praise ourselves for our cooking style.
Well, for a long time, I don't think we had much to praise. Not until in the 60s. Up to that point, it was pretty bland, dull food almost generally across the United States, other than in areas of New York City where there's still a food mafia. The food of the Pacific Northwest was interesting, more interesting than most. The foods of the New England area was bland and dull. In the South, it was spicy hot. But there wasn't anything that distinguished anything. Now there is.
Anything that just now, I'm sure there are people from New Orleans who would take grand exception.
I'll go further.
Or people from New England who would say, "My God."
Well, the people from New England can say "My God" all they want because the food is still just like it was a long time, just not very interesting. But New Orleans, that's a different thing. That's probably the only cuisine in America that really is unchanged. It's been good from the beginning if you grow up there. But if you grow up, as I did, in the Midwest, and then move to New York and then to the Pacific Northwest, my body isn't put together for all that spice and the hot stuff. And everything in New Orleans is wonderful, but it all tastes exactly like the first thing I eat when I get there.
That's true. It's very heavy.
It's very heavy, and it's also very hot. It burns your lips.
Specifically the red beans and rice, or...
Practically all of it.
What about all that French cuisine and...
That is... In New Orleans, you mean?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Well, all that French cuisine in New Orleans is pretty heavily spiced.
Uh-huh.
Because that's... If they don't... I guess I can explain it best this way. In Chicago, last year at the Big Food Show, there was an enormous banquet with wonderful food. And all the people from New Orleans, and there were a lot of them there, Ella Brennan, who's probably the fanciest of all of the New Orleans restaurateurs,
uh-huh.
They put lots of salt and pepper on everything they ate because it didn't have any taste.
Taste, uh-huh.
Of course, they're used to a lot of spices in it. So even the French food there is very heavily spiced, and it doesn't taste like French food you find anyplace else.
So, well, exactly. It doesn't taste like French food in France.
Or in New York.
Or in New York. That's true. I worked with some Japanese for a while in New York, and they would go to the hospital cafeteria and put a lot of MSG on their food, obviously, because they felt that it didn't taste without that. And maybe that's the same thing with salt and pepper, that it's a question of how our palates get used to.
It's what we grow up with. It's what we're used to all the way along.
But you grew up in South Dakota, and you praise that plain American cooking.
Well, my grandmother came from Kentucky, and she really had a real flair when it came to cooking. There are many things that I try to duplicate today that just plain don't taste as good as I remember them then, and I'm sure that they aren't as good as they were then. But she could make a cobbler out of anything, and it was really good.
Uh-huh.
She did things with root vegetables that made them palatable.
Did she have a wood stove?
You bet.
Uh-huh. Do you think there's something to that, the way the flavor is?
Oh, I don't know if... I don't know. I really don't know. When it comes to breads and baking, I think the wood stove makes a big difference.
See, actually, I think you're a visitor to Fairbanks, and you've come just at the end of our gardening season. We have seasonal constraints on us, but I think during the gardening season, we get some of the best produce that there is. Jennifer's frowning at me.
I think some things are very good, and some things, you know, aren't. I mean, I think that we're also happy to have something really fresh right out of the garden that it just tastes like heaven.
Yeah.
You know, like anything out of any garden tastes. It's heavenly.
I was reading your cookbook the other day, and we were talking about chickens. You were talking about chickens in the. You weren't talking. You were writing about chickens, and there is a real difference between mass-produced, fast-raised chickens that go from the egg delivered to us by Frank Perdue in 3 months or 6 months or who knows how short the time they have, and chickens that are raised in a more natural way. There's a real difference in the taste. My grandparents lived in Alberta. My grandmother used to go out every Sunday and chop the head off a chicken and dump it on the wood pile and let it flop around. And those chickens and those noodles were just fabulous in my memory.
Well, there's an enormous difference between a chicken that's scratched in the dirt and one that's grown up on a screen. The reason we don't have those anymore is, number one, there isn't anybody that's going to sit around and raise that many chickens because we eat millions of them. I think that Purdue probably slaughters about 600,000 chickens a day to keep up with the demand. There's another thing. The chickens that are raised in our backyards, and those that still do this, the chicken has to be, it's killed, and it has to be cooked that day, or hardly even held over to the next day, because the chickens that we buy in the markets are fed differently. I mean, they're built or grown to withstand what has to happen when they have to sit around for a while.
Mm-hmm.
But you're right. I give me a chicken that's scratched in the dirt, I'll have it every time.
Mm-hmm.
It's also a different color meat.
Mm-hmm. It's more yellow.
Sure.
Less white because of what it eats. Dear audience, our number is 474-5044, and I encourage you to call. You all know something about cooking. You have to either eat someone else's cooking or do your own every day, and so you're certainly an expert to that extent, and you must have an opinion on this subject. So please call us, 474-5044. I would really like you to enjoy the expertise and lively opinions of Richard Nelson. So please call us. All right, so there is a difference in ingredients, the way they're grown and or raised, than they were in your grandmother's day. But there is, it seems to me, a real lively interest in good cooking, increasingly so in America.
Well, there has to be. I think there's something like 1,900 cooking schools in the United States today. There are 1,000 members in the International Association of Cooking Schools, and then there are all kinds of people out there that cook all the time. There's an enormous interest in it today. Julia Child is probably the reason for it. I mean, you saw her on television. It started 19
Certainly.
Years ago, and it was, aside from a hell of a show, it was pretty good food that was coming out, and people started to go into this.
Has it been 19 years?
As a matter of fact, it's 20.
20. Hello, you're on the air.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes.
This is just a small cooking story about my grandmother who cooked in South Dakota.
Oh, I'm interested.
And it's that when you said that about the cobblers, I thought, aha! And she really did tremendous things, and I remember her around our house in California, but she was still cooking the same way. And I asked her once when I was finally grown up and realized that she was probably just a treasure trove waiting to be, oh, I don't know. I knew that I needed to get some of these recipes down.
Right.
And I asked her about pie crust. I thought, well, she'd been on a farm for years and years and cooked a million, baked a million pies for hired hands and all that. And I said, Grandma, what's the best pie crust? How do you do that? How do you make that? And she said, she was about 88 years old by this time, and she said, well, honey, you go down to the Safeway and get that Betty Crocker pie crust mix. And I was stunned and disappointed when she thought, it's better because it's easier.
Well, so, she probably had something there.
Yeah.
My grandmother made, I was convinced, the best brownies. And I went to school near where she lived, and every once in a while a platter of brownies would arrive that was just fabulous, and they were the best. And I moved up here, and I missed my grandmother's brownies, and they didn't travel. And she began to get on. She was getting in her 80s, like your grandmother, and I thought, this is ridiculous. And I said to my father, listen, be sure to ask her, get the recipe. I need this recipe. And this very strange, garbled story came back, and I thought, well, my father doesn't know how to cook. I'm going to have to go home and visit. And I went home and visited, and I said, all right, what is the skinny? You make the best brownies. What are they? And it was the recipe on the back of Nestle's Toll House, you know, the semi-sweet chocolate ones.
Oh, no.
And they are. I think they're the best still.
That's how I make Toll House cookies. The recipe ran on the package. And because it has butter in it versus, I don't know, what other shortcuts other people might take, people at various work locations that I've worked have always praised my chocolate chip cookies. It's straight off the Toll House package.
But there's nothing wrong with that.
I have a friend who makes what I think are the best chocolate chip cookies, and she swears it's because she uses that recipe, but with margarine.
Oh, well.
There we have it. I mean,
well, anyway, it was a surprise to me, but I just thought, well, here's another South Dakota grandma story for you.
Her perspective might have changed in 40 years or something. Maybe she made a different pie crust when she was...
Oh, I'm sure she did.
Sure she did. It was just that this was easier and
right.
Where in South Dakota?
In outside of Aberdeen and in Pierre. It's South Pierre.
That's where I'm from.
Really?
Sure. Well, that's where I grew up. I haven't been there since 1949, but it's Pierre.
In Aberdeen, they say, yeah, we're going down to Pierre.
That's right. That's the only way you know they really come from South Dakota.
Do you know the Wetsteins?
No, I don't think I do.
Well, I'll be sure to look them up the next time you go.
No, I'm never going back to South Dakota. I told him in 19, and I still have relatives there, and I told him in 1949 when I was there the last time, from now on, if you want to see me, you come where I am.
How often do they do
reasonable.
That?
I'll let you talk now. I just wanted you to...
Thank you.
Yeah,
thank you for sharing your grandmother's pie crust with us. Do they come see you?
Oh, yes. Oh, sure. Not often. That just suits me fine, too. No, they're busy. I mean, I have a cousin. That's really all that's left. And a cousin who's come out two or three times to see me. And until very recently, other relatives that came that are no longer living.
Mm-hmm.
But I have no interest in going back to South Dakota.
Well, you spent some time there,
sure.
So you know what it looks like. It probably
sure.
hasn't changed
I didn't leave
that.
Anything there.
It hasn't changed that much. Our number, audience, is 474-5044, in case you have some grandmother's recipes you'd like to share with us. How did you first get interested in cooking?
Well, I've always been interested in it. I remember as a kid, I grew up on a ranch in South Dakota, and there was... There were a lot of hired hands. I was too young to be out working with daily chores much. My grandmother always let me help her with the canning. If she was stirring something for a cake, she always let me do that. And I've been interested forever. I didn't know anything about it until I was 21 years old, however, because along in there I had to go into the service, and Lord knows I didn't learn anything about cooking there or anything about food.
That's clear.
And when I graduated from the Pasadena Playhouse, I went to New York to work in theater, and I met Joseph Platt. And Joseph Platt, to date myself, did the sets for Gone with the Wind. And his wife, June Platt, wrote probably some of the finest cookbooks that have been written and published in America.
You make frequent reference to her in your cookbook, and I must admit that I've never heard of her.
The last book that was published that she did was in 1956. There was one that came after that, but this had to be ghosted because June was at that point almost totally blind and really incapacitated. But there was another book that came, and that was probably about 1977. But 1956, up to that point, she had published a book called Plain and Fancy, The Best I Ever Ate, the June Platt Cookbook. I think there were probably seven altogether. She was to Alfred Knopf, the publisher, what James Beard is to Alfred Knopf today. Mm-hmm. She was probably the most highly regarded cookbook author at the time. And I was lucky enough to work with her for 8 years. And she's the one that gave me the sophistication about food.
I guess from that time, the only book that I use regularly, or the book that was handed to me by my mother, was The Joy of Cooking.
Which is a marvelous book.
Is a real classic. You know, if you don't know how to cook canned beans, it'll tell you. and it sort of starts with that basic stuff, but it is very plain, and it's not...
That and Fanny Farmer.
Fanny Farmer, right. Although I was from a Joy of Cooking household that somehow didn't use Fanny Farmer. But June Platt was then a little bit before this sort of fancy...
She was way ahead of her time.
Cooking school really caught the
oh, yes.
public imagination.
Oh, yes. But all of the cooks, certainly the New York cooking people, they still know about June Platt today, even though she's been gone for quite a few years at this point. She had the respect of all of them. She was contributing to, I believe it was either House Beautiful or House and Garden, clear back in 1939.
Uh-huh.
I mean, good recipes.
Uh-huh.
As they say, she was just way ahead of her time.
And so you went into her kitchen and started cooking with her?
I started helping her by testing recipes for her.
Mm-hmm.
She taught me the most that I know about food. Mm-hmm. Certainly the most awareness.
And she had a fairly American, quote-unquote,
American
style.
Very American.
I was interested I also have a cookbook that I use a lot called the New York Times Cookbook, and it was a sort of...
I hope it's the first one.
The blue one.
Yeah.
That I got back in 1963.
A good book.
And the thing I like about that book versus the early cooking that I did with Julia Child is that if you come home from work, you could do a New York Times recipe and still eat dinner before midnight. Mm-hmm. You know, it's fairly...
Not so with Julia's.
I'm going to disagree
okay.
here. Because if you've read Julia and you understand it, it's not true of all the recipes. But, I mean, you know, if you read Julia and you learn how to make a souffle, you can come home and okay, everybody thinks souffle is fancy. The fact of the matter is you can be home, make a souffle, and have it on the table with a green salad and, you know, some French bread and a perfectly nice dinner in under half an hour. And I'm not trying to be a snoot. It's true. There are things in there in Julia's that take days. But
it's true. And the other thing if you slowly and laboriously go through Julia's recipes a few times, obviously they become you get faster at them, and some of the techniques are just.
They're just
a little difficult to master, and once you
master
them.
But it's not a difficult thing to master. It's just she takes a lot of words to make sure that you understand completely.
Well,
I really
true.
Believe that.
That's
I think
true.
I think she's excellent.
And that is one thing about Julia. You can cook. You can use her books without going to cooking lessons.
Well, you can also use her books, and no, you're not going to have a flop because there's not a mistake in any of them. I mean, her recipes are thoroughly tested. I have never yet found any of her recipes have any typos or any mistake of any sort. She's meticulous.
Yeah, that is an amazing thing. My sister does a lot of cooking, and she made a recipe, and she was sure that there was nothing wrong with her technique, and the recipe didn't turn out at all well. And she wrote to the cookbook author and said, something is wrong here. And in fact, they wrote back a letter and said, yes, several people have noticed, and we're really sorry.
Do you know the other story about mastering the art, which I'm told is true? It may be apocryphal, and that is that they sent off the only copy after 8 years of work putting that book together. They sent the only copy to Knopf from France, and it was lost.
This is Julia's Mastering the Art of French Cooking.
Mastering the Art, Volume 1, and it was lost, and they rebuilt it. It took them another 5 years. I am told this is true. I don't know if it is. You might know more than I.
No, I don't know about that.
I was told so.
That's to kill.
Xerox everything before you send it to the publisher.
Isn't that amazing?
All right, we're going to go back to your life story. You say in your book, lots of people get very nostalgic about the soups of their childhood. I was converted to soup at college, which is unusual since most people remember college food without much enthusiasm. It was a delicious bean soup that did it, and my early love of bean soup has extended to all kinds of soups. That was in a college...
Yes, in Lawrence, Kansas, as a matter of fact, at the University of Kansas. It was a dreadful little place. It was kind of a honky-tonk, but they really made wonderful bean soup. We all went there. It was better than we had in the fraternity house, I'll tell you.
And you didn't like soup growing up?
Well, no.
I read that, I was sort of surprised, you know, it was just bean soup.
My grandmother didn't really have a knack for that. The reason I talk about my grandma, my mother hated to cook. She only cooked about three things. And one was cream chip beef, which she did a good job of, and we had it on toast on ordinary times. And if we had she had cream chip beef on a baked potato.
That's wonderful.
You know, it wasn't bad, but my grandmother made soups. She didn't have a real knack for soups, and it was always vegetable soup, and it was the tail end of everything, and it just didn't have much taste to it. Anything else she did was magnificent, but the soups, no. And so I was disenchanted about soups until I found that bean soup, and then I started looking for soups, and I found out the soups were really wonderful.
I agree with you. Soups are good, and you make the point that sometimes people put too much in soup. And it masks the taste.
That's right. Some time back, we lost the art of fresh herbs. Probably when Spice Islands found out you could put them in jars, and everything came dried and you had it for a long time. So people weren't growing fresh herbs. Then about 6-7 years ago, it became fashionable to grow a lot of herbs again, and people discovered fresh herbs. And when one was good, they thought more is better. And they started putting in, you know, 4 and 5 different herbs. They liked the herbs, but what they didn't realize was one was knocking out another, or 2 or 3 were counteracting another, and just putting too much stuff. Now we're down to where it's simplicity again, and you're looking for a specific taste. I had a soup tonight that I had at Jennifer's, as a matter of fact, which was a vegetable soup, which was a very nice vegetable and potato. It was a very nice soup. It had a particular flavor. It didn't have a lot of flavors. It had a particular flavor, and I found it delightful.
I think we want to be assaulted. Sometimes our palates want to be assaulted these days. We have so much salt in our food, and there's so much fried food in the American diet.
It was a terrible pun. It was a terrible pun you just made about assaulted, didn't you?
No.
I didn't intend that.
I really didn't intend that. But we are assaulted, I guess, is what I wanted to say. And you were describing the fantastic cooks from New Orleans just salting and peppering their food to death. And now it's even become a health hazard. So we have reason to really look at it, that we may be taking shortcuts in the taste of our food by just putting a lot of salt on rather than thinking about the spicing.
Well, there are other things you can use. Some things require a little bit of salt to bring the flavor out. I think I feel that everything in moderation, fine. If anything you overdo can cause you a problem. I would dare say that if I stopped eating any salt at all, my body would have a hell of a time getting adjusted, because I've eaten salt since I can remember. Mm-hmm. You know, there was a time when salt was good for you. I don't know whether they've changed the salt or they've changed something else that we eat, but something is causing a problem with that. And if the doctor tells you can't have salt, don't do it. But if he doesn't, I don't think you have to knock it off completely. I think use a little bit of it in certain things, but use it in moderation.
You had an association with James Beard. He recently, on doctor's orders, did a...
Not recently.
Not recently.
No, a long time ago stopped.
Yes. How long ago was that?
Well, probably about 1970, 72, 73, somewhere in there, they wanted him to be on a salt-free diet. And I was traveling with him a great deal of the time at that point. I worked with him closely for many years. And I decided that the only way to keep him clean was to do exactly as he was to do, and that was have no salt on anything. And he tried to convince me that a little bit squeeze of lemon juice and a little bit of thyme on scrambled eggs was just about like having salt. Well, I ate that for about a year, all the time trying to convince myself that it tasted like salt, and it didn't. You know, there's nothing worse than an egg without salt on it. As a matter of fact, my grandmother made a comment one time, had nothing to do with this, but she said, eating an egg without salt is like kissing a man without a mustache. My granddad had a mustache forever. That's what I knew. But Beard cheated all the time. Every time there was a saltine or a cracker anyplace, Beard always ate it. So he was getting that salt. It meant a great deal to Jim to be on the diet, and he didn't consume near the amount of salt that he had up to that point. Well, he lost 100 pounds.
He certainly did. And has he maintained?
Well, he still weighs about 256. He was very large, but then Jim was big when he was little. Uh-huh. I mean, at the age of 3, he was big.
And, of course, in the cooking profession, actually, our audience can't see you, but you are extremely slim and trim.
I don't eat this stuff.
Cooking gets it out of your system.
No, I fight it all the time. I don't think it, in my profession, I'm standing up in front of people cooking all the time. And if I was obese, I don't think it's terribly attractive. I mean, who's going to want to do what I'm doing, or who's going to want to have what I'm fixing, or who's going to want to eat the food that I prepare if I'm, you know, all out of shape? Well, I keep myself at 150 pounds, and it is one awful job.
It takes
because I was up to 184.
Paul Prudhomme obviously doesn't.
We were talking about
your
today.
School. Paul Prudhomme, for the audience's sake, is the chef at K. Paul's in New Orleans. That restaurant has, in fact, gained great fame.
Oh, in the last two or three years.
Very unusual kind of blends and flavors. And
Cajun food at its absolute best.
At its best. There were lines around the block when he took his restaurant on the road, which is also a sort of novel idea, and went to San Francisco. I mean, they were...
Oh, he really knocked him out.
Standing room only.
A marvelous guy. He's great wit and
but
a tremendous
talent. But he weighs
talent. 480 pounds.
He's really massive.
He is big. I have a photograph of the two of us in Houston last year. We were sitting side by side at a dinner table, and fortunately the photograph was taken from my left and he was on my right. Otherwise, you never would have seen me. But I looked like a pin sitting beside him. He is big, and that's too bad. I don't know what the problem is. I hate seeing it because he has to walk with walks with braces on his legs. He takes two canes. He can hardly get around.
But is your sense, since you go around traveling a lot, that it is an occupational hazard for chefs and professional cooks?
I would say it's an occupational hazard. Most all of the cooking teachers or the people that cook like as I do around, most all of them have a weight problem or they're fighting a weight problem.
Before we get off this subject, what is your opinion of the Nouvelle Cuisine? It was.
I think about it as little as possible. It had a great start, and it didn't know when to quit. There's still some of it that's around that is good, that's nice.
Could you define it for our audience who doesn't know what the heck we're talking
Nouvelle
about?
Nouvelle cuisine is simply a new cuisine, a new kind of cooking, and it was developed in France, and I think it was partially developed because a lot of the traveling people were losing their interest in the classic French cuisine. Classic French cuisine can only be made one way. And once you've eaten it, it was a comparison of the same thing all the time. And there was tremendous interest in the United States in food and in cooking. And we were going way past the French, and they wanted to get this thing back. They'd always been the leader in food. And Bocuse and Michel Girard, a number of them, started developing a new, lighter kind of food with wonderful saucing and so on. They got carried away. I mean, somebody got carried away with it. The most interesting of all of the recipes that I ran into was in a Trogo cookbook, and it was a spinach salad, and it was in the Nouvelle. And it's the same spinach salad all of us have eaten for years, you know, with bacon and chopped egg and so on. Well, they were calling that Nouvelle Cuisine. But the worst of it was raspberry puree with petrolli sole. And here is a bed of raspberry puree on a plate and this poached or sautéed sole right across that. And the combination tastes really aren't very good. That was Nouvelle Cuisine.
So at its worst.
At its worst.
That it got really crazy in trying to be sort of different.
Everybody seemed to be trying to outdo each other.
That's exactly what they were doing.
With, you know...
Oddness.
I mean, and things got carried. I mean, I think the kiwi fruit is a great and good thing, for instance. I think it tastes good. But, I mean, if you serve me a main course with a kiwi on it, I know that where you're coming from. Sardines and kiwi, you know.
I've had kiwi on everything, I think, but a baked potato. I didn't serve that, you know, come out on something.
Well, the Australians are probably really glad for this.
They pushed it hard, but you know, a kiwi all by itself is wonderful.
It's very beautiful.
Sure, slice it in half and eat out of it with a spoon. It is wonderful. Or with a little bit of raspberry. It's terrific.
And the one thing that it seemed to me looking at the Nouvelle Cuisine books is that it sort of introduced the Japanese influence that food should look good as well as taste good, and that
which is not a bad thing.
You know, three piles of globby gray on the plate is not appetizing.
On a blue plate.
It is not
a bad thing to have beautiful food. But to have it, you know, if you have a family of six or four or three or two, and you're a working parent or you're a not working parent, you're a parent or anything, you know, to pull that off every night is not something you necessarily want to aspire to. I mean, you want to be able to feed your family and maintain your sanity most nights of the week, I think. And that's where you get into the concept of good food, you know, food that your family likes to eat and that doesn't make you crazy.
The thing that was such a pleasure to me preparing for the show and looking at your cookbook was that most of the recipes, I had all of the ingredients in my house, which my house is a...
That's important.
My house is a relatively well-stocked house in terms of spices and so on, but not extraordinary. And there are a lot of recipes that really call for some extraordinary shopping trips,
not
which aren't
book.
Even possible in Fairbanks, and that's true, not in your book. And you also say in your book, you might try my recipe as it is written the first time, but after that, go for it. If you want to depart from the recipe, that makes a lot of sense.
I should have added something to it when I said that in the book. You know, make it as I've made it the first time, and if you don't like it, you can delete what you want, you can substitute something for something else, but when you get through with it the second time, don't give me credit for the recipe anymore. Claim it as your own. Don't say this is
write
Richard
your own,
Nelson's.
Write your own book.
Yeah.
Okay,
mm-hmm.
Now I have a tough, now I have really, a, I'm going before time goes on too far in case the answer turns out to be a long one. This is the end of moose season, as you know, in Fairbanks. I'm sure someone's told you that important fact, have they not?
Yes.
Yes. And there are a few wild game books out, but not a lot of recipes for that. The other day when I was going over to someone's house for lunch, I passed three on my way to their house. I passed three open garage doors with people in there butchering, obviously, either caribou or moose. And so it's clear that a lot of moose is consumed in the interior. Now, we have a lot of moose in our house because a friend has more moose than they can deal with. A moose is a very big animal, in case you're not aware. There's a lot of meat to deal with. So Sam has been rendering bones and so on for 3 days. And now all the meat is off the bones and the fat and so on. We are looking at head cheese recipes. And it says, take the head of one hog or pig. Now, how much is that, and how do you translate it to moose bones? Do you have
I haven't the remotest idea, but I'm expecting to hear from Nanook any day, and I think I can find out.
Wait a second. Are you sure do you like head cheese?
Oh, I love it.
Oh, okay. Because if you don't,
I love it. That wonderful gelatin.
What people in the interior do, native people, many of them do, is really fabulous moose head soup, you know, and that, you know, I am not in love with head cheese, but moose head soup is something you should seriously consider, too.
Well, if you do moose head soup, Do you just use that moose head once, or do you...
I think you use it once, but you can feed a lot of people. It's what you do for potlatches.
Uh-huh.
Or it's what many people do for potlatches.
But we do really have a lot of ingredients in the interior and in Alaska that aren't necessarily treated routinely in cookbooks.
The best thing I can tell you for moose was something that they did in Chalkeetsik, which is where I lived when I first came here, and that is that they would take the jawbone, when everything else was done, they would take the jawbone and stick it in a fire and cook it and then break it open and eat the marrow of the jawbone, and that was incredibly good.
We do have some access to some meats and some raw materials, raw foodstuffs here that other people do not have, and I was sort of amazed when I went to New York this summer that... In fact, many of the vegetables that I have access to here are much better than some of the things in New York markets, which is sort of the kind of standard. I mean, when I go out and pick fresh raspberries right off the berm in front of
there's
the house...
There's nothing like
there's
them.
the fruit market in New York's raspberries are not as good.
Well, aside from that, a half a pint of raspberries in New York is something like $8-$10. And, you know, a half a pint of raspberries is an awful small batch.
Yes.
And they aren't nearly as big as the raspberries you pick yourself, nor what I pick in Oregon. I mean, we have marvelous berries there. The produce you find in New York is not nearly up to snuff, I don't think. It's not nearly as grand as they claim it to be. It's not anywhere near what you harvest in your own garden.
Mm-hmm.
And you do have what you do. I've had your tomatoes. I had carrots today. I will say you grow giant ones. The carrots were giant. The tomatoes were very good.
Tomatoes were nice. They were local. They were.
And as a matter of fact, I went through I've been through one market, and I thought the produce section was beautiful.
Uh-huh.
It is every bit of what we have in Oregon, what they have in California, and what in any market. I mean, in any supermarket.
The nice thing about living in Fairbanks is nobody expects anything of it. So when they come here and they find out how much
thrilled.
We do have, everybody's just amazed at how nice it is.
I think, in fact, it's changed substantially in the last just few years. Even since I've been here in 5 years, it has changed, and we have much more variety. When you talk to Alaskans who grew up here, they really did not have a taste for fruit because they didn't have a lot of fresh fruit or only the berry crops in season, but certain other kinds of tropical fruits they didn't have access to, and so they may not have a taste for. So I think some of these are developed tastes, and they weren't available, but your great support of root crops is certainly something that we have in abundance in
Fairbanks.
I can
relate to all of that, because in growing up in South Dakota, there's not much there either. There is today.
Right.
But, you know, 40 years ago when I was a kid there, even earlier than that, there wasn't much. I had never eaten an avocado. I'd had apples. I had had oranges, such as they were, and apricots. Most of the things I had were dried fruits because that's the way it was shipped in, or were canned.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd never eaten salmon, anything like that, anything fresh. I'd eaten canned, any of that stuff. And you have to get someplace to develop a taste for things. And then once you develop that taste for it, you're going to go home and you're going to see to it you have it some more.
Mm-hmm.
And you're not going to grow oranges up here. You're not going to grow bananas, things like that. But you're going to get them from good sources.
Mm-hmm. Although I must say there's something to be said at least in my opinion, for seasonal anticipation of foods when they come in, asparagus in the springtime
and you
those
first... some in the fall now? There's some in the market right now.
Mm-hmm. Where is it coming from where?
I suspect Mexico.
Mexico?
Uh-huh.
Well, it never tastes the same as it does when it's growing, when it's in season where you live.
And fresh tomatoes, those first fresh tomatoes and strawberries when they come out of the yard and so on. I just think looking forward to them and eating a real quantity of them when they're fresh and at their best is really...
There is no product or there's no produce that comes into the market from any place that tastes like the produce that comes from your backyard. The tomatoes... You know, they're picked green and they're forced ripe in refrigeration, and you cut them open and they're sort of a pale pink inside. They don't really have much taste,
mm-hmm.
but we've all gotten used to those things. Unfortunately, the best thing I can say is when your tomatoes are probably up here good pretty much year round, aren't they? Someplace? No, not even in the markets from some other place.
No.
Well, if you're forced to use a tomato that isn't very good. use canned tomato and use a fresh tomato from the market, chop it up and put it in there with it, and at least you have a taste of fresh, and it's better than having the tomato as it was.
Well, I must say that I actually found that when I was living in New York, that there would be these sort of attractive-looking tomatoes in the market, but very tasteless because they were obviously good travelers and good stores. And you would go across the river, even in summer, and there were all these, New Jersey is known as the truck gardening state, and there would be these luscious tomatoes, but you couldn't get them across the river unless you traveled yourself.
That's
so
right.
Our number is 474-5044 if you'd love to get a word in edgewise here.
They're going to have to work at it.
Okay, so obviously, there's no substitute for good ingredients. That's what makes the good
that's
beginning
what makes
of any
good food.
Kind of food. So we have to start there. But then you're a real advocate of plain cooking and sort of straightforward cooking. I'm surprised at I started to mention the New York Times cookbook because a lot of the things that you have in here are things that have some Italian derivation or have some Mexican derivation, but they've become really part of the American vocabulary terms of cooking. Why is
America
that?
Is the only country that is a mix of every other country in the world. You go to France and you don't find this great mixture of ethnics. England, you don't. You find certain ethnics. But in America, every race is represented in America. And the people from Italy who came over here, migrated over here, they brought the kind of foods that they were used to. They had to adapt them to the materials that we have over here. It's all American now, every one of them.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the Spanish-type foods, the paellas, they're American at this mm-hmm. point, brought by the Spanish people, the Mexican people, the Tex-Mex, the French that ended up in New Orleans and in that area. We're a mixture of everything. It's not American cuisine. It's American cuisines. It's plural.
Mm-hmm.
Because there are many cuisines in America.
Mexican food is a real good case in point because the California-style Mexican food and the New Mexican-style Mexican food and the Texas-style Mexican
all
food are different. And none of them have I ever found in Mexico.
That's right. You find no cumin as a spice or herb in Mexico.
Hmm. It's coriander.
Coriander and also epazote. Epazote is just it's a weed as far as I can tell, but it has a flavor, and you'll find that epazote called for in a lot of Mexican dishes, but you never find cumin.
Uh-huh. And it's very
that's
distinct.
Our adaptation.
Coriander is very distinct taste.
And it can overpower.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
It's nice,
easily.
But it can really overpower.
Uh-huh.
You have to be careful.
You also make that point about sage, that people tend to have an association with sage in dressing, and they may use too much, and they may use it too consistently, that there are other flavors that you might want to consider.
Exactly.
However,
one of the nicest things I've ever eaten was in Italy, and it was a deep-fried sage leaf.
Hmm.
It was wonderful.
Should we try some tomorrow? I think I have some outside the door.
Well, we can try it. Probably won't be the same because the sage is probably better in Italy than we have here.
This was grown outside my door.
Esther. Oh,
was that in Taormina?
In Florence. Giuliano Bugiali, who's a cooking teacher and a friend.
You mentioned Taormina in the book, and that really took me
back.
That's
a heaven place.
It is. I was there in the spring when the almond blossoms were in bloom, and there's a volcano there, and it was snow-capped, and it sort of spews a little smoke. And the food is wonderful there.
You're absolutely right. It's very simple.
Very simple. A lot of artichokes, stuffed artichokes I learned to make in Taormina because we were staying with a family there.
And squash soups.
Do you know what sounds the most decadent to me? The thing that's somehow, and by decadent I mean, you know, really wasteful. I never understand how people can do this, where you read of stuffed and deep-fried squash blossoms.
Oh, I do that.
Do you have that many squash blossoms?
Yes, and when zucchini start taking you over.
I never have that many that I can do that.
Actually, we discovered that, my sister and I discovered that recipe in Oklahoma when zucchinis were converting to sort of baseball bat size on an overnightly basis, you know. We were giving bags of zucchinis to meter readers and to everyone who entered our driveway, and then we thought, we've got to stick stem the tide here. How can we do this? And then we saw, aha, squash blossoms.
I never have enough, and I always wonder how you feed it to 20 people.
Well,
but
do you really like the French fry or the deep-fried squash blossoms?
I've never had
lot?
It.
Oh,
never
they're
had
wonderful.
It.
I think that delicate flavor is great, and I have people who come around in the
you
summer now
me
looking.
Next summer.
I'll
looking
have
for
to come
tempura
and try yours.
Fried, tempura battered. Squash blossoms.
Do you use a little bit of alcohol or liquor of some sort in the batter for
no,
the crispness?
No.
Well, usually when I've had...
I use a Japanese recipe
for tempura.
Tempura batter.
When I've had squash blossoms, I've fixed them, but I don't fix them very often. I really couldn't taste much except the batter.
Well, they have very delicate squash flavor. Hello, you're on the air.
Hello.
Join in anytime here. Hello?
Yes. Chris, listening to people talk about food is... wonderful. I can do that almost any time.
Mm-hmm.
But I was wondering if you would, or if your guest, Mr. Nelson, is willing to talk a little bit about the way he conducts his school. He's in town for a cooking school, I assume.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I didn't catch the beginning of the program. I wonder if he'd talk a little bit about just what he does in the school or what he offers in his class or the procedure.
Right, good.
Well, I think I'm going to turn you over to Jennifer Jolas, who's responsible for me being here. I could go on and on about what I do in cooking classes, but she's seen me in action for 2 days and had to clean up after me, so she might have a real answer for
he
you.
He makes dirty dishes. No, it's the classes.
How about if I hang up and you just go ahead?
Are good. You sure you might not have some more questions?
She can call back.
You can call back. Okay.
Right.
Bye. The classes are in my house in Esther, and it is by accident, but in fact the house works out very well. There, we have a long bench that rests on a half wall that overlooks an 8-foot counter, and there Richard cooks, chops, slices, talks, waves his hands, walks from there to one of two stoves, and begins cooking. And the classes are running about average of 4 hours, and we are doing, it seems, about six or seven dishes each day. And it takes about 2 hours to start eating, and then it never stops until we're done. The menus that we're doing are grouped by region. So, for instance, this afternoon it seemed as if much of what we did had a Southwest flavor. We did a Mexican bean soup. We did fry bread, which I'd never even eaten before. We did something that was not so Southwest, but we did a marsala custard for dessert. And Richard does it. The students enter in and do some of the work in a situation where it's important, for instance, that they get the feel of what a dough feels like, or, you know, how can you tell when the fry bread is done. But most of it is demonstration, and that largely because of the confines of the kitchen.
Well, ordinarily, all my classes are participation. The classes, the cooking school in Oregon is all participation. I only do demonstration when I'm in place, you know, when I come up here or when I go out as a guest teacher. The menus will be pretty much balanced. That's usually 7 things each day. However, at home, when it's a participation class, we do 11 things each day because there are usually 10 people there and want everybody to have something to do. But it's all I can get done here to do 7 dishes in that 3 hours.
There are lots of questions. There's lots of talking back and forth. There's lots of this is what's happening here, and here are different things that you can do with this. And you know, for instance, with the marsala custard, I mean, we must have spent 15 minutes discussing different flavors had we used different liqueurs with it. Lots of doing. Lots of eating, too.
What? How long have you been teaching since...
Oh, gosh. Well, my own cooking classes, I started in 1977. But prior to that, I had assisted James Beard from 1971. Then he encouraged me to open my own cooking school, which I did. And I continued to work with him until 1979, when I opened another cooking school on the coast, which worked at the same time his worked in Seaside. And it was time for us to split up. I was still his West Coast associate. And he just felt that I should do something on my own. But actually teaching only since 1977, but I've been involved in food since 1948.
What do you think is the reason for this incredible popularity of cooking schools, cooking classes, fancier cooking equipment. It seems especially astonishing to me at the time that most of the women are going back to the workforce, that these sort of things coincided.
But a lot of these same women have the children are grown now. And they have a rekindled interest in food. I mean, for a long time, it was pretty dull stuff. You know, forever, it was a woman's lot in life to cook. And I don't blame them for not being very damned interested in it. You know, they had 5 meals or 8 meals a day to prepare, depending on how many kids they had and who was in ballet and who was in Little League and whatever else. And all of a sudden, the emphasis is on food. There are many food magazines that are really good magazines, and everybody's interested in all this, and we're Americans. We're very hard to please, and we're also curious about everything that's happening every place, and we try to stay on top of what's going on every place or be involved in whatever's going on. And the cooking school started. Julia Child made it interesting as the Dickens watching on television. I mean, she had one of the biggest audiences in the world watching all that.
And she also made it possible to fail and still keep going.
Sure.
It was okay to make mistakes.
Sure.
A very charming personal style that you could say, oh, my goodness, you know, the chicken flew off the counter and the souffle would come out collapsed.
Sure. And, you know, we're all human. And I don't know, but there are as many men in cooking classes as there are women. There's a totally different attitude that the men have from what the women have.
And how is that?
Well, the men sort of, if they make a mistake, it's so what? And the women are really kind of uptight. I prefer a class with men and women both because then there isn't that same, the competition. If it's all men, the competition is fierce. And if it's all women, it's fiercer. I mean, you know, they're really going to get it done. If it's a combination, it's very smooth flow, and everybody's interested in it. And they're all interested in how many things they can do with one basic step or what they can really produce on a, you know, as far as a dinner is concerned. People are interested in eating out, but they're far more discerning about what they eat out.
Mm-hmm.
And they want to be able to do these things at home.
And you think there's a tendency to do, or there's a trend toward doing things that taste good but are sort of
that
streamlined,
are not hard
simpler.
Work. Yes.
Simpler.
That's what this book is really all about.
It does reflect that you don't need to do 52 steps and start 5 days in advance.
If a recipe is more than one page long, I'm happy to eat it, but I won't cook it.
Now, that brings me to one fascinating recipe that you have. Eggs that you prick little holes in both ends, you blow them out, you whip them up, you discard part of them, you then make some dough, you put them back in, you put this egg mixture back in the eggs with a syringe, you make little dough, you put caps of dough on these eggs that are sitting back in the egg carton.
You know what I called it?
You put egg surprise.
Sure.
Eggs.
Surprises if you do
now,
it.
Wanted to know, and you say, well, you know, I rarely do something like this unless it's worth it, and for very special occasions, I will do this. What struck me about reading that recipe is, how did it occur to you? It's sort of like, how did they figure out you could eat olives? How did you figure
Wait. I know what you're getting to. I am not a recipe developer. I'm a cook. I'm a cooking teacher. This particular recipe, Egg Surprise, is something that June Platt was very interested in a long time ago. And I finally got the recipe for her. I don't remember all of it. It's a long, long time back. Finally got the recipe for her, and I had to test it. And it really, I don't know what it was called, but I called it Egg Surprise because it was a whale of a surprise, and it isn't nearly as hard to do as you think. And after you've done it once, I dare say you'll do it again.
If you're very compulsive,
you know,
and neat.
Recipes.
This Jennifer is just reading this recipe, shaking her
you've
head.
You've got to have something campy, and you know, just write just another cookbook. I mean, you got to do something here.
You wanted to make sure you'd read the book.
I know you've read the book. This is the test question.
You know, I read the book. Actually, I read this and I thought, well, you'd need 6 children who are bored and it's snowing
outside.
Well,
if you've got them, use them.
And they need to be blowing eggs. What does this taste like? I couldn't conceive of it.
Hard for me to tell you what it tastes like. It's a dessert
custard.
Yeah, it's more a dessert.
It's a custard. It's a baked custard.
Yeah, it's more of a dessert than anything else. And it really is a surprise. And when you crack the egg open and you have your custard cup all right there, it's really kind of wonderful. You're not going to do it every day.
Certainly not. I don't.
Patty and I are sitting here looking in horror. You must be joking.
Dumbfounded. But the other thing that I really think we need to give a couple of minutes to, because it's really integral to your introduction, is spoon bread souffle. You cross-reference it throughout the
It's my favorite thing.
The book. You say constantly, this would be good with spoon bread souffle. What is it, and how in the world did
it's
you...
It's wonderful. We had it today.
How did you discover this? And
well, I've always liked spoon bread. I like anything that has that's cornmeal base. You know, I like just plain old fried mush. Polenta, and oddly enough, cornmeal is a staple all over the world. I mean, it started right here in America. We're the ones responsible for corn. And it went from here. The Italians grabbed it, and they... Polenta, that's all it is just... It's cornmeal mush, really. Well, the South, the Deep
Stick
South...
Stick with us. This is going to get good. I know. Everyone's going, oh, my God.
The Deep South is really into spoon bread. And that is simply a mixture. It's like a mush. You start off with a mush that's got a lot of butter and stuff in it, and you bake it, and it is awfully good. It's good with everything except... I guess it's good with everything except ice cream. Good with everything. And I started... Since I like that, and I am adept at souffles. I can make a souffle with almost anything, and they aren't hard. People think it's going to be, it's a real job to do a souffle. That's ridiculous. It's one of the easiest things in the world to do. And so it doesn't rise as high as you want. Put it in a smaller dish. It's got to go someplace. It's going to go, it's going to rise. In this particular one, I simply added a combination of some cheddar cheese and garlic. And it's worked right into this dish, and it's an absolutely wonderful flavored starch to serve with. It's wonderful with pork, wonderful with chicken, it's wonderful with beef, it's wonderful with everything.
Or by itself.
Absolutely. As a matter of fact, I would suggest when you do this and you have six people that you're serving, always double the recipe because they'll eat it all.
So this is one of the things that's going to make you a famous cook. If you
make one a famous cook or...
Make one, yes. Anyone who puts this in their repertoire, well, it's made you a famous cook, but among other things. But that this is one of those recipes that if you incorporate it into your repertoire...
You're going to have a winner, and you can't possibly have a failure with it. If you follow the recipe, you cannot have a failure.
I made your pot roast the other night, and I am certainly going to have a try at... spoon bread souffle. It sounds... We're always looking for alternatives to the sort of dull starch that seems to be a mandatory thing. You know, you do rice, you do potatoes, and so on. You need...
I'll tell you another changes. One that's a fast one that's a good substitute for starch, and that's a puree of chickpeas. Garbanzas, just plain old garbanzo beans. You don't have...
Canned?
And get them canned, Lord, yes. Don't go through that thing of soaking them and boiling them. It takes forever. Just buy them by the can. For six people, I would say three cans, drain them, and if you have a food processor, put them through there, or if you don't have a food processor, cook them with maybe two or three tablespoons of butter in them and a little bit of the juice, and cook them till they get fairly soft. Mash them through mash them with a potato masher, whatever you want to do. And add a little bit of whipping cream to it, maybe two tablespoons. Mash it all up, and it is marvelous. You don't have to bother with salt and pepper. It's all right there, and I guarantee you people are going to say, this is wonderful. What is it?
Uh-huh.
And you can tell them or don't tell them. I mean, if you want to keep the secret, why, whatever. It's good.
Keep it as a surprise. Now, Jennifer, I hardly had any time to quiz you about your career in cooking. Jennifer started as an amateur and has become a professional, and I certainly owe a lot of good memories of food experiences in Fairbanks to you. And I thank you for that. And I thank you for bringing Richard Nelson and his American cooking to Fairbanks. I guess if someone's interested in finding more about Richard, they could call you at the Movable Feast.
Yeah. Yeah,
give your number.
456-4701.
Okay.
Was that beautifully done?
Right. if you have some more questions about that. I hope you enjoyed this show as much as I did. I forgot I was on the radio, obviously. We are moving. Our time is moving to to Saturday morning next week, 11 o'clock in the morning. set your alarms and get up and join us at 11 a.m. next Saturday morning for the Home Fires New Time. I've enjoyed this evening tremendously. I look forward to talking with you next Saturday morning at 11. Our executive producer has been Carla Tonella, and I've been your host, Patty Castelli. Have a nice evening and a good week. Thank you.